Strange Show here on WWPR 1490 AM. Reminding you, you can find us in a number of ways online, whether it's the Facebook page, our podcast site, on numerous podcast sites, whether you use Apple Podcasts, but the biggest archive would be henryrainshow.podomatic.com, but just Google the show, Henry Rain Show, you'll find it there. Also follow us on Twitter. And in the studio today, we have blockchain developer Dr. Stephen Lubka. Sorry, I almost graduated you to a doctor there, Stephen. But you just sound he just plays a doctor on our show. Working on what projects are you working on? You had a couple.
Yeah. My main project I've been involved with is an IoT data marketplace application for Finect, and I've also served as an advisor to a number of projects, including research and some VC firms, and working with new people all the time.
And also in the studio here, our perennial Augie, used to be called the contrarian, now we just
sort of
just look over and say Augie. And on the line with us, you heard the audio from their website at aptlyhealth.com for the break. Dr. Jerry Beinhauer is a veteran physician and serial entrepreneur. He and his team of co-founders launched Aptly Health earlier this year to enable employers who self-fund their health plans to directly contract with healthcare providers, cut out intermediaries, and save upwards to 40% on costs. And it's been probably a couple months since I've mentioned it on the show, but I used to sit on the healthcare advisory board for Manatee County here. So I have they may have moved on from when I was there, but I still have questions about how they used to do things there that I think Aptly Health might have been able to help them with. But first, let's say hello and good afternoon to Dr. Jerry Beinhauer. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Beinhauer.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much, Henry. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, so before we get into Aptly Health specifically, I was looking at your LinkedIn profile, and besides Aptly Health, you are also the CEO of Aronexus LLC, which served as a healthcare data nexus enabling, and I saw you were a physician, obviously I'm the doctor, with Co-Remedies Hospitalist. But then I'd go down a little bit farther, and I see you were with a company called Ayurveda Networks, responsible for developing and managing wireless alternative access networks. Did you have a career change in midlife?
Yeah. So I always joke, right? So I'm a physician and also a techie nerd. And it's funny. So I was in network engineering prior to medical school. And now I joke because, I used to take my wife then to medical conferences, and she would say, wow, man, docs are really nerdy. Now we go to blockchain and insurance conferences, and she says, please take me back to the dirty doctors, because now there's real dirt here.
There's crazy doctor conferences.
I have a diverse background in technology and medicine, that's right.
So, you can refuse to answer any of these questions, but how old were you when you made the decision to go into medical school?
Well, so, I was in my early 20s when I started Ayurveda Networks, actually in the telecom space. I was working, like I said, in network engineering and kind of saw a huge problem there. Back in the day, we were looking at trying to find a wireless alternative way to bypass the local exchange carriers, the GTEs, or back then, the GTE of the world, or 9X, Pac Bell, because every time there was a problem with our circuits, we had a national fiber network. It always really was a problem on the last mile, so we looked at that. And I've always had kind of an interest in medicine. I was an emergency medical technician while I was still in high school. I went through that training and did that as well. And then realized I wanted to try to merge those two together. So I went to medical school, and then all through training had always been involved in the IT side of things. So as a medical student, you kind of do anything you can to make money. And as I was rotating with a lot of physicians, they were just starting to implement electronic medical records, and they'd say, hey, Jerry, you know this IT stuff. Can we hire you to implement this? And I was like, sure, absolutely. So that kind of got me really more involved in the IT side on healthcare, and then it kind of just flourished from there. I think I call it either, I don't know if it's a gift or a curse, but I seem to find things that are broken and want to fix it. You know, my wife's a godsend because she sticks with me through these things.
So I'm trying to get a little more chronology, not at you personally, but when I was managing a practice in 1996, I got some of the first presentations, and you probably, if you were even in offices back then, I know there was a local doctor who was very significant who was still doing his patient records on index cards. And,
oh,
you know, our doctor was just, you know, scribbling notes in a folder. And when I had him look at the first presentation, I had just gotten my degree. I said, well, you need to look at what we can do to computerize and make your records more efficiently. And when they came to present him what, this would have been 97-ish, what a medical record, electronic record, at that time would do, he goes, they can't really do that stuff. Well, and you know, so we never went anywhere with that. But were you at a point with your doctors as you were trying to introduce this, not Apley Health, but in your prior activities, where they said, we're never going to be able to do this?
Actually, what's funny is it had gotten to the point where the doctors realized, not a lot, but some of them that were kind of tech savvy and kind of saw that there was, you know, that was coming down the pike, they had already looked at several systems. And as when I was a medical student, they wanted me to kind of work with them on installation. So I was installing servers at the time, you know, in their facility, putting in Wi-Fi networks, implementing the devices, setting it all up, and kind of showing them how it works. I wasn't writing the software code or anything. It was more installation of existing systems. And back then, there weren't a lot of vendors that we had worked with then. Actually, a lot of the ones that they had implemented was EMDs at the time.
So in between your technical tasks, what type of medicine did you practice?
So, I mean, that was, of course, when I was in medical school, but actually I was trained in family medicine, but always worked in the hospital. I've always liked kind of the inpatient setting, and we actually started and run a hospitalist group up in Hernando County. So that's always been my focus on the healthcare side.
Let me go over to Augie here because he's got a thing or two of experience with doctors. So go ahead, Augie.
My finger was pointing to the time as a break, but since I have a little bit of experience, I'm a bionic person. I had aorta replaced back in 2013. I collapsed, and I was bay flighted up to Gainesville because the only doctor that knew how to do this procedure of replacing this in this old guy was there, a guy by the name of Martin. And the technologies that I've noticed change since I've been down this pipe for extended periods of time, 10 weeks in the hospital, 11 days in a coma, things like that. I've seen when you go in to see someone, in one particular doctor I went in to see, he would do what you're talking about, the index cards and so forth, and fill out the form. And then he had an operating area within his practice. He had to do it all over again. These people, they're living in a past that they're comfortable with, don't want to leave. And the question I have for you is, how do you get them there?
And you can take that all the way up into Apley Health, because that's the flip side of it, the business side of it. How did you get them to the medical records, and then how do you phase them into a new way of doing their transactional business?
Yeah, so don't forget, so, you know, I didn't have to, or really the vendors did not have to convince the doctors to transition to EMRs. What really did was money. So when the High Tech Act came out, if you're familiar with that, briefly where the government compensated physicians and hospitals to implement EMR, EMR adoption went from 15% utilization to 80% almost overnight in a really short period of time. So the government, the High Tech Act, had provided that funding to push providers to implement EMR. The next phase of that was supposed to be interoperability, where that information within those different siloed EMR installations could eventually talk with each other and share information. That was years and years ago that came out. The interoperability problem still exists. And then that actually was part of what we addressed with OroNexus, the company that you mentioned, because we were actually connecting the different disparate systems and integrating that information into a central repository, sort of a, you know, in a cloud-based system. And we actually at that point had built a rudimentary blockchain system in 2014 to accomplish that, so out of necessity, but we didn't even know it. You know, we didn't really know that we had built a blockchain for that use case, but we did because it worked. And that kind of then led us then further down the road towards Apley Health as well. So it was kind of interesting. It was really governmental legislation that really kind of pushed utilization of EMR.
Big bad government, right?
Yeah.
Well, so here we are now. Apley Health is a different aspect of healthcare. And you, really, if you look at the employees that are involved in healthcare, I don't know, but I'm guessing half of the employees, if you especially include the insurance industry, are just focused on getting transactions done, paying for services. So that's a huge part of healthcare. What does Apley Health do?
So, you know, kind of a light bulb moment for me with Apley. So like I said, is I own a hospitalist group. And, you know, doctors, hospitals, you know, physician groups, they contract with insurance companies like Blue Cross, Blue Shield, United, AvMed, Aetna. And Medicare rates, or some percentage thereof, are typically the benchmark that providers look at when they're contracting with those payers. So I'm holding a contract from Blue Cross that says that they want to reduce my reimbursement rate for a hospitalist group down to 80% of Medicare rates. Then on the TV comes a news report telling me that healthcare costs are rising, $3.3 trillion. And it really got me wondering, where's the money going? And I'm not saying that doctors, hospitals don't make money, of course, but why is it that one aspect on the delivery side seems to be having a constant reduction in reimbursement, but overall healthcare costs are rising? And as a physician, believe it or not, and most docs that I talk to, and most people for that matter, have never really heard of or understood the concept of self-funded employer-based health plans. I didn't. But when I looked into this to see who was really footing the bill for healthcare costs, it's really broken down into three categories. It's the government, Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, the Indian Health Service, is paying about a third of all of that $3.3 trillion. Commercial insurers that are providing plans that are what's called fully funded, where the insurance company is taking on the risk themselves, are paying a third. And then the other third, and actually it's a little over a third, is self-funded employer health plans. They're spending about $1.1 trillion a year. And collectively, self-funded health plans are the single largest payer in aggregate for healthcare services. Self-funded health plans, it's really hard for people to understand or grasp if they don't know this, but this means that the employer, so Home Depot, Walmart, United Airlines, Delta, some of the big, big employers in the country, and now it's even gone down to even employers of a few hundred employees, they actually run their own health plan themselves. They take on the risk. They're running the plan. Because they don't have the infrastructure to operate that plan or a network of providers by which to deliver care to their employees, they typically contract with companies like United or AvMed or Aetna to administer that plan and lease that provider network from those carriers. And when I saw that, I started to wonder, well, that contract I was holding with Blue Cross where they were going to pay me 80% of Medicare, I wonder what they're charging the employers on the other side. Because 60% of the people that are carrying an insurance card that says Blue Cross, United, AvMed, Aetna aren't really insured by those carriers. Those carriers are just administering the health plan of their employer. So it's a huge number. 100 million lives in the U.S. are covered under these plans. And what we found was those carriers, by being the intermediary, they're marking up the provider rates 2 to 3 times. And collectively in the U.S., that adds 300 billion, not million, but billion with a B, dollars in added cost to those employer health plans with no added value. So we saw that as a huge, huge problem.
So we're speaking with Dr. Jerry Beinauer. He is the CEO of Apley Health, based in Tampa Bay. The website is apleyhealth.com, Apley spelled A-P-P-L-E-Y, and you can also follow them on Twitter and elsewhere. And just as a sidebar to this, because you've been talking and using the launching example of how Blue Cross Blue Shield, when you were contracting as a doctor or as a physician group, that they would say, we'll give you 80% of Medicare. We're here, when we hear politicians, if they're not talking about how to improve the Affordable Care Act, we're hearing them talk about, oh, we got to put competition back into the marketplace. But when you have insurance companies that control such a large groups of employees, it's you really have an oligopoly, if nothing else. And the other part is they hardly ever look at what's going on with the individual patients, at least at the level you're talking about. They're looking at what Medicare has approved and what Medicare will pay for, and they're basing their decisions on that. I know there's more to it than that, but is that out of line with what your observations are?
Yeah, so if you remember, so if you think of, and it's usually easier when I give talks around the country about this, and I have diagrams, right, or at a coffee table I have props, right? I use the salt shaker and the pepper shaker and my coffee cup, right? So if you can imagine having an employer-based health plan on one side, the providers on the other side, and then in the middle is the coffee cup, which is the insurance companies that are administering those plans for the employer. And what's happening is there's two contracts between those three parties. One contract between the insurance company in the middle and the provider. That's based on some percentage of Medicare rates. Then there's a second contract between that insurance company and the employer. And the employer, this is real dollars. This is employer's money that they're generating from selling their products and services, that they're just asking the insurance company to administer their plan for them. And the delta between what the insurance company pays the providers, Medicare rate, and what they subsequently charge the employer, some percentage of quote-unquote charge master rate, is what is the $300 billion a year take that the insurance companies pull out of the market. And they're also charging those employers a per-employee, per-month administrative fee and typically a network access charge to give those employees the right or the ability to access that provider network. So it's a huge problem.
And the idea that all these hundreds of thousands and millions of patients are making decisions in a marketplace like they teach you in economics class is really a fallacy. You've got... you don't have free flow of information. You've got information is key, and that's where I think Apley Health is one of your leverage points, is that you have the knowledge about what's going on. So how do you actually, you know, we brought you on because it's blockchain. How does blockchain make you do something better than just being a person with a lot of experience and knowledge helping these employers negotiate a better deal?
Exactly, and that's a great question. And this is a question that we are asked all the time, and I love to answer it because, you know, there's so many companies out there that are using blockchain as sort of a hood ornament, and it's almost like they're a blockchain company looking for a problem. For us, it was a lot different. Is we found this huge problem, and then we decided, you know, what can we do to fix this? And we spent a long time talking to the employers and the providers and really validating the problem and then asked them, you know, if you had a magic wand, what would you do to fix this? And the resounding response was we would create a system that would enable us to directly contract and transact with providers at scale. Now, that's happening today. Henry Ford Hospital and GM entered into the direct contract with each other. Orlando Health and Disney did as well. Now, if you're an employee for one of those companies within the Henry Ford Hospital or the Orlando Health coverage area, then you're great. But if you live outside of those areas, those employers then still have to lease the provider network from other carriers. So what we realized is that we could use blockchain as a technology, not because it's cool, but because it is specifically designed to help enable two parties to directly interact and contract peer-to-peer without an intermediary in the middle. What we then realized is that those self-funded employer plans, they need a lot more stuff than just direct contracting. They need telemedicine services, chronic care management, stop-loss insurance or reinsurance to cover their downside. So all these different things that they need, they typically are also purchasing through the insurance companies, and that's being marked up as well. So we said we need to really, and we can't really be everything to everybody. So what if we created an environment where we can pull in other vendors, partners that deliver services to those self-funded employers and collaborate together to provide more efficient, more cost-effective solutions to these employers and their employees and the providers as well. Now, we could do that in a centralized marketplace and just be like, you know, another Amazon. But we realized that because healthcare is so big, and if we really want to make a difference, we could leverage a distributed network, a distributed application, or a DApp, and actually run a blockchain solution on that that enables all of these partners to collaboratively operate and deliver their services through this open marketplace, open ecosystem. That's when blockchain and the distributed architecture really makes sense. And what we've found is that we're getting all kinds of partners that are coming into the ecosystem wanting to deliver their services to all the participants involved. The analogy I like to use really is that, you know, there's a core group of us, Apley Health and a couple other partners starting this off, that are building the railroad tracks. And then Apley is like Amtrak on those tracks, providing the direct contracting between the employers and the providers and the transactions. Then other partners are like CSX and Pacific Coast Railway, all riding those same tracks, but because those tracks are governed by the collaborative, everybody wins, and we are even seeing now competitive vendors coming into the marketplace simultaneously to work together to really move the needle in healthcare.
Let me turn to the only blockchain developer we have in the studio right now. He's been listening to you quietly over here, and let me just see what kind of observations or questions he might have.
Hey, it's
Stephen Lupka.
Hey, great to meet you. So that all sounds really great. And to sum it up, my understanding is essentially what you've done is you've provided a framework so that these employee-funded, you know, an employer can fund their own plan. And instead of needing to hire and contract out all of the operations of that to an insurance company, you know, you allow them to directly interface, directly connect and transact with actually a number of other parties, not just healthcare providers, but also the kind of ancillary services. Is that kind of correct?
Correct, exactly.
That's really cool. Out of curiosity, so how does your blockchain network run? Who are participants in the ecosystem? Are they working and running it? Kind of what's going on there?
Are you running on top of some other platform like Ethereum, or do you have a token?
No, so we did something that was really interesting. So right now, you know, and I'm sure you're aware, in healthcare, a public-based blockchain where there's, you know, non-permissioned nodes, it's really difficult because under the current legislation with HIPAA,
sure,
if you were my patient and I'm your doctor, even if I took your record or any of your information, even your medical billing claims, and I hashed that information, even that hash is considered PHI, protected health information.
Yeah.
So that means then even if I just put that hash on a public blockchain and there's someone hosting a node on that chain, and God forbid there's some form of a breach in any way, then me as a provider, I'm responsible for that.
Sure.
So it is a permission-based blockchain, but the permission is governed by the collaborative. So Apley being the initial creator of the collaborative and the other partners being involved, what we're able to do then is create kind of this system where we're all focused on delivering this system that encourages valuable and value-based services to these employers. So, you know, it really creates, I think, kind of what healthcare needs is this ecosystem where any of those participants, the employers, the employees, the providers, and even other partners, vendors. So we have chronic care management, general health maintenance, vendors who can also partner with other vendors that have access to certain data that they need on the ecosystem. So it really creates this environment and this overall architecture so that that HIPAA compliant, healthcare focused, identity verification is a core aspect of it. It creates a master patient index with an API library, which I think eventually that's where the healthcare data access space is going to go. Leave the data where it sits and then just access it with patient submission through an API to the different installations. And all that basically pulls it together so that those partners can all deliver their services and products collaboratively and all benefit from this network effect that it creates.
Dr. Binera, I just want to alert you. We schedule-wise, we've got about 10 minutes left, but effectively we can run a little bit over if we need more time to explain some of these things. But I am going to try and move us down the road a little bit more on this. We're speaking with Dr. Jerry Binehauer. He is the CEO of Apley Health, and the website is appleyhealth.com, A-P-P-L-E-Y, health.com. You can get a video there that does a great job of showing what Apley Health does and how it uses blockchain to help self-funded employer, self-funded insurance for employers hook up with a network of providers and handle the transactions. So how far down the road are you on the business model of implementing for Apley Health? I mean, as far as having employers that are currently using it, or having how vast, how big is the network, what regionally, what does it take care of? How many patients might you be monitoring? What can you give us as a metric?
Yeah, so what we did is we actually first built our MVP based on that magic wand question that I mentioned a minute ago that we posed to the employers, which was, you know, if we could create something, what would it be? So we built the MVP that enables the self-funded employers and the providers to directly sign up on the platform and contract with each other. So it's almost like Uber, right? So a driver can download the app. In this case, they can sign up through our web interface as an employer. They can actually then build their network of providers through the application. The providers can create an account, but it's not on a one-to-one basis. So it enables the providers to create an account, then participate in Contract 1.0, which is based on some percentage of Medicare fee-for-service. It's at 120% of Medicare, so the value prop for the providers is get paid more, get paid quicker, and then the employers pay less because it's a direct pass-through pricing transparently at that rate and not getting that 200 to 300% markup, but they could participate in that contract as well. So basically every provider is available to every employer, and every employer is available to every provider. What our next step now is actually expanding the marketplace and partnerships, because we've had a ton of employers and providers signing up to participate in that. But now we're bringing in more partners to backfill a lot of the services that those employers need. And actually, we're doing that, too, the funding for that, using a security token offering. Are you guys familiar with that?
Sure.
Actually, we were talking about it right before the break where we brought you on.
Sorry.
Not yours
in
particular, but that topic.
I came in
on
a red eye out of San Francisco, and I couldn't listen in earlier.
Well, but before you go there, let me just ask you, because I'll just mention the story that we were talking about and ask if you had heard about this. This was the SEC coming to an agreement with two ICO companies, but AirFox and Paragon Coin. But it was the first time the SEC has compelled two crypto startups to register their token sales as security offerings. And it goes on to say that 95%, it looks like the SEC is building up the case law to view 95% of the coin offerings, security token offerings, as securities that they regulate. Have you looked at that issue in, as you go forward with your offering?
Yep. So we have a securities attorney that's a former SEC regulator. Now, one of the things that's not new in the securities law is the ability to have an offering under certain exemptions to the rule. Are you guys familiar with Reg D 506 offerings, private
placements? For accredited investors?
Correct. Okay. So that's what our security token sale is structured as, is a 506C Reg D offering only to accredited investors that are verified that they're accredited. They have to go through KYC, AML, and their verification. And all those steps are defined by the SEC. But the interesting part in that, what we're finding, is that, you know, although it's not what would you would look at as an old, last year, traditional ICO, where it's just offered to the public, is we're seeing a ton of interest on the part of, you know, physicians that are accredited, other investment funds, obviously, that are accredited, because they see the value in what this thing can do for physicians in general, get paid more, get paid quicker, but also in the companies that these investment funds have in their portfolio that are offering health insurance. So the savings for them are immense, 30 to 40% cost savings. Makes a lot of sense with being involved in supporting infrastructure that can help reduce that.
Okay.
The third part about our token structure is when you think about a lot of these tokens, sometimes they're not tied to the business whatsoever. That sort of had been the issue with some of the early ICOs. It was just the token they created, and then there was a hope that it would be a valuable on a secondary market, and that's what drove the value, but there was really no business behind it. If you remember the scenario that I mentioned a minute ago about how we're building the railroad tracks to support multiple parties to run their trains on those tracks, well, these security tokens are designed to represent a revenue share or a royalty in all of the transactions, the revenue that's generated from the trains that are riding those tracks. So it becomes really attractive, in fact, because basically we're enabling the early folks that are involved with us, accredited investors, to own a piece of those tracks through the revenue share, so a royalty right. They basically get to become Cornelius Vanderbilt back in the day, but building the tracks are designed specifically for healthcare.
Okay. Let me, Dr. Beinauer, again, we're speaking with Dr. Jerry Beinauer from Apley Health, APleyHealth.com. On your train tracks, if we're going to continue that, with the train tracks in the real world, we have some cargo that we want to get from point A to point B, and you get a fee for receiving that cargo. A lot of our medical care system, you are receiving a service and you're paying a fee for it. And Apley Health can come up with a much more efficient or cost-effective way of doing that as you do that. But there's another trend besides just paying for your service more efficiently and thus creating savings is wellness management. And for, you know, Medicare has the merit-based incentive payment system that they've been implementing, and you have other quality measures that different health insurance companies look at. As you move forward and you get more successful with Apley Health, and you're very efficient and doing a better job of actually making the payments, and everybody's happy with that, how are you going to then manage wellness with your system?
So this is the thing to me that's even more exciting than everything we've been talking about, actually. So smart contract 1.0 on the blockchain-based distributed dApp ecosystem that we're talking about is Medicare fee-for-service rates. So contract is based on fee-for-service with the Medicare pricing schedule as the Oracle. So just to, for non-blockchain people, smart contracts on a blockchain platform typically have some Oracle, which is a truth teller, that the two parties that are contracting through blockchain agree upon to serve as the determinant of the auto adjudication or execution of that contract. Now, smart contract 2.0 on the Apple Health platform is based on value-based care. And this is what's really cool to me, especially as a physician. So let's look at an example. So let's say today a payer, like an employer, wanted to enter into a contract with a provider and say, hey, Dr. B, I want to pay you a bonus if you can get all of my diabetic patients at 98% compliance with their hemoglobin A1C ratings, diabetic foot exams, eye exams. Now, in order for me to, for the payer to do that, that takes a lot of work. As a matter of fact, one of the major payers in Florida and who's all, and also is a major fiscal intermediary paying Medicare claims told me they employ about 500 nurses whose sole job is to gather data to see if they can objectively determine if providers are performing appropriately in those value-based, performance-based contracts. Now, take that relationship, value-based, performance-based contract 2.0 on the Apple platform, and enable the real-time access to that data with patient permission, because their providers now are incentivized to interface their EMR into this platform so that they can get paid that bonus. And now you could actually, with a click of a button or automatically through a smart contract, run, let's say, weekly, monthly, quarterly, however often, and determine within milliseconds how well Dr. B is doing in managing those diabetes patients. And if the payment interval is quarterly, is when it runs that quarterly, it actually can trigger that payment from the employer automatically. Mm-hmm. Average cost for a claim processing today, that's by standard payers, the carriers, to do contracts like that, is actually about $26 per claim.
Okay. Dr. Beinauer, we're running up against the clock, so let me just ask one more question along this line, and then we'll have to say goodbye, and maybe we can continue this conversation on another show.
Sure.
You know, with electronic medical records, because this data has to go in there, too. I mean, maybe it does. Maybe it can be redundant, but, you know, optimally it wouldn't be redundant. You'd be pulling it from electronic medical records after it gets entered in. That is such a fractionalized space so much. With, you know, you haven't gotten to a critical mass with any of the electronic medical records, much less get them where they can talk to each other. There's so many. Is that an obstacle that you see coming down the road for Apple Health that's going to have to be addressed?
Well, two things. We had fixed a big portion of that with my last company, OroNexus, from a technical perspective. From a business perspective, I think what we're going to see is legislation that's basically going to require EMR vendors to provide access to their information through API access. And within the Apple platform is a master patient index API library that'll serve as a way for patients who are also involved in this equation to actually grant access to that information and pull it on the fly.
Okay. So you just opened another door on me, and I'm going to have to extend the show another minute here. How did your previous company solve that problem?
So we actually, this is, remember I mentioned we had built a blockchain system years ago and didn't realize it. We actually had found a way to actually aggregate information into a central repository. We also had found a way to aggregate that information in a de-identified format and maintain chronology of events. And all of that can be applied to an installation like this. The business problem that we had is we weren't really solving a problem to encourage EMR vendors and providers to want to connect to this infrastructure, but by tying that now to reimbursement, if they want to get paid a bonus by through performance, then it becomes an issue where it's still their choice to actually to connect to the network like this, but they're going to want to do it because it'll be they can actually can make a bonus by doing it.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending a couple extra minutes with us just now. We got into the weeds a little bit, but on a personal level, I found it pretty fascinating. We've been speaking with Dr. Jerry Beinhauer. He is the CEO of Apley Health. I encourage you to go to the website, appleyhealth.com. Again, Apley is A-P-P-L-E-Y, health.com, or you can follow them on Twitter, at Apley Health. And educate yourself, because really a better patient is one that's more informed about how the system worked. And, again, Dr. Beinhauer, I hope you come back and talk with us again, and I really appreciate the time you spent with us.
I'd like to do this again.
I appreciate it, too. And, unfortunately, we didn't get to talk about the benefits to the individual employees, the patients, but there's a ton of those, too. But make sure that any folks that are interested in owning some revenue right in the railroad tracks, they can also go to meetapley.com and register for a token sale.
All right. Well, we'll have you back as soon as your schedule permits. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Take care.
Well, that's revelations. Well, you know, every now and then we stumble across something in our backyard that's really interesting and exciting. So I want to thank Augie for making it in again this week. Next week, heads up to both you and the audience, expect to have a best of show, a rerun show. We're going to replay the interview with Daniel Estulin.
A little
off our normal groove where we are here, but we've got a lot of interest in it, a lot of outside, both in the blockchain world, but outside too, about his views of the Trump administration, where he's taking the economy. And that will be a prelude. The replay of his first interview will be a prelude to the following week when he's coming back and he's agreed to allow us to pick his brain a little more specifically and understand that we've covered the concept now, and we're going to get into a little bit more specifics on that. I want to thank Stephen Lupka for joining us this week. And so next week is a rerun. By the way, all the meetups are on hiatus for a while until we find a new location, so don't go knocking on Connect Bradenton's door. And we'll then be back, though, the Saturday, not the Saturday immediately after Thanksgiving, but the weekend after Thanksgiving, we'll be live again here in the studio. And, again, thank you all for joining us here.
Happy Thanksgiving, Henry.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to all in the studio.